Continuing with Bruce Elsmore on 18th August 76. What were the special problems that you had specifically?
As far as I can remember, the main problem was to get a system that was reliable in as much as it stayed stable from one day to the next and gave us the same answers. Various technical reasons, our equipment wasn't very stable.
Right. And when you measured a fringe amplitude, it was in terms of what were the units? I mean, what did you compare it with?
What we had, in fact, were two aerials mounted on a sort of trolley arrangement, and the whole business meant that we were looking at with the aerials at one particular spacing for half an hour, then moving the trolley out to a larger spacing, and then observing for a bit longer, another half an hour, and so on. But of course, this was more difficult now because all the time the sun was moving around the sky,
right.
So we had to consider the foreshortening of the baseline due
right.
to the position of the aerials relative to the sun. So that was the sort of problem which we were up against. And I think the one factor which caused us more trouble than any other was the radio cable, because at that stage we had some very old German low-loss cable that we were using to combine the signals together. And this was German radar equipment. It was very difficult cable to manage because it was about inch and a half diameter
mm-hmm.
with a very heavy metal screen around the outside, and the plugs and sockets were not ideal, so whenever we sort of moved the aerials apart we invariably had trouble with bad connections where the cables had to be
right.
connected to terminations into the receiver and so on. And so this was one of our problems.
So it was basically this portability that was
That's
making
right.
the problems.
That's right, yes.
Which was the unique aspect.
And one found that you couldn't sort of do one observation one day and one the next because the receiver stability wasn't sufficient, but you could really rely upon it. You really wanted to do it all in one fairly short span of time.
Yeah, yeah. The first thing that you actually published was the 1C survey. Was that the next thing you worked on after 10 years?
I think so, yes.
The aerial?
That's right. And for that, we built a broadside array. And we had, this was a fixed array, of course, with a fair number of dipoles at each end. And we, the part I did in this particular operation was I produced a method of analyzing the results, because they were all a bit sort of variable and unreliable, and so by somewhat of a statistical process that we actually arrived at the source positions. Day to day they sort of dotted around a bit.
Can you describe what this process was, or is it described
yes.
in the paper?
It isn't really described in the paper, at least I can't remember it being described. We had the records which were produced every 24 hours, and these were analyzed to determine the position of the fringe system that a star passing through the interferometer beam produced. And from the periodicity of the fringe, we measured the declination of the
right.
source. And by selecting what we imagined to be the middle of the envelope of
right.
fringes, we determined the right ascension, rather from the timing of that. And this was done for over a period of time, analyzing lots of days of records. And what I did was I produced a large sort of planisphere, which was about 3 feet in diameter, a great circular piece of metal.
Right.
And round the outside was right ascension. And it had a sort of scale on it, going from the center, which represented the North Pole, down to the edge of our limit, which was about 0 degrees declination, had a scale which was in perspex,
mm-hmm.
with a scale of periodicity on it.
Right.
And so, simply measuring the period, this then gave us a plot on the declination scale, and twiddling the sort of cursor around to the time of day. And it also had a device in it which actually had the date going around the outside, like these planispheres that you buy for observing the sky. And all this was a sort of automated process of analysing the records.
Right.
And after, I can't remember how many records we analysed in this way, we ultimately came up to sort of little groups of dots on our planisphere. We said, oh, well, there must be one there, and there must be another one there, and so on. And this is really how those positions were derived.
I see. How many days went into...
But this is what I can't quite remember. I would say probably a couple of months at least. So something like sort of 60 observations.
How many dots would have to be within a couple degrees before you called it a source? Can you?
Well, some are very obvious, of course.
Right.
When we would see the same source every day. But the more sort of difficult sources for us to see would be somewhat spread out and have, say, only 20 dots out of the 60 before we would consider it to be a source.
And those error estimates that are in the listing of the 1C, they sort of derived from the...
They were sort of derived from the spread of the dots
on
our planisphere.
It wasn't a formal error as one would do now, adding
That's right, because there are so many variations that produce instrumental effects as well as other effects that we decided this was probably as good as we dare go. I mean, it was silly. It would have been silly to do a formal least squares fit or something on the data.
Were you involved at all in the business of trying to find associations with galaxies?
Well, in a sense, I was. I was in. I suppose most of my radio astronomy life, I've been concerned with measuring positions, and for that reason, I was probably the person who used to contact the optical astronomers in those days and say, "Look, what do you think might be causing this radio source?" But of course, our positions were so inaccurate and had such large error bars on them that the task was absolutely a formidable one. From their point of view, there was a few of the first identifications were fairly obvious, like the Crab Nebula. That was one of the first I remember.
But Martin Ryle just told me that there was quite a bit of skepticism about the 1948, or 49, I guess it was, Australian paper in which they suggested the Crab, Centaurus, and Virgo identifications.
That's right, yes. They were, in fact, right, of course.
Right.
But...
Are you saying that only when you've gotten some better positions... Did you
No, I wouldn't. I would say myself that certainly the Crab, we were pretty sure that their identification of the Crab was the correct one almost as soon as they announced it.
Mm-hmm.
The source in Virgo had a slightly more checkered career because I think it started off in Coma Benericis.
Right. Well, that was that's correct. That was Bolton's original short paper with six sources where he was 5 and 10 degrees off.
Yes.
But that got corrected pretty quickly.
Yes, I think that's right.
And then Bolton, Stanley, and Slee came up with these 10, 20 arc minute positions.
I think they probably had better success than we did in those early days, mainly because the sources which we mainly concerned with, of course, the Cassiopeia and Cygnus sources being the brightest from our northern hemisphere observations, were very much more difficult objects to identify.
Right, indeed.
And this was... I suppose the reason that we suspected their identifications simply because we had a source which we knew was very much more powerful, with no obvious identification.
Right. We had the two strongest.
We had the two strongest, the Cygnus and Cass sources. Yes.
So who were the optical astronomers that you talked with?
David Dewhurst mainly.
Right. And I just talked with him yesterday.
Oh yes, that's right. Well, he's been the most cooperative, I suppose, of all the optical astronomers in that, certainly in the early days.
Yeah.
We were very much considered to be an inferior race, of course. I mean, we probably were not justified in calling ourselves even radio astronomers in those days. And I feel that looking back on those days, that the optical astronomers quite rightly viewed us with considerable scorn. But they were very helpful.
Well, since you've been concerned with positions, maybe you can verify a story I've heard that there was some no knowledge about precession or something like this, and or perhaps it was even sidereal time, that you had to be informed about that at some stage.
Oh, I can tell you about that story.
Yeah.
Well, one of the first papers that we published was the, I think it's the Perseus source in NGC 1275. John Baldwin and I did it.
Yes, that's 54 when it was published.
That's right.
Right.
Well, it's really, I think what you're referring to is the fact that when we published this great position for this object, we published it in Nature, and we produced it with right ascension, increasing from left to right.
Oh. A real no-no.
Yes. Right. And as soon as this was published, I had a sort of polite but somewhat cynical phone message from David Dewhurst to say, "You ignorant radio astronomers, let's learn that right ascension increases the other way." But this is a justifiable mistake in a way, because all our charts, you see, have time going increasing to the right-hand side like
that. Well, personally, I feel that it doesn't make any sense to do it that way. I mean, that's just a convention.
It's a convention because it's the way the optical astronomers look at the sky.
Right.
But having little experience of looking through optical telescopes, we defied the...
But you don't remember something about sidereal time. I mean, just the very existence of sidereal time, this sort of thing. Somebody was telling me, and I think it was the Cambridge group, that they had to get educated on that at some stage.
Oh, I'm sure we did. Yeah, I'm quite sure this is true.
Yeah.
I think that when I joined the group, I think it probably was fairly firmly established.
That education had already taken place.
It already had taken place, so it was probably before my
day. That probably makes sense.
Because I'm pretty sure when I did the planisphere thing for the 1C, we had it all organized.
Sure. The next thing that you're down here is Ryall Nelsmore in Nature in 51, in which you monitored about 100 radio sources. Almost daily for 18 months.
To try and get, that's right.
To look for time variations. Can you tell me about that? That's a hell of a lot of work.
This probably arose from the same sort of records that we were using to produce the 1C survey and these little blips on the, these little fringes. And at this particular time, we thought quite firmly that all the radio sources which we looked at were constant in intensity. Things like Cygnus and Cassiopeia and the Virgo source, they didn't appreciably vary at the low frequencies which we were then using. And so we analysed sort of week after week of these records, and particularly the brightest ones like Cygnus and Cass and so on, we could measure the amplitudes fairly accurately for them. We came to the conclusion that these sources were in fact constant in amplitude. And we thought this at the time was a useful contribution because we knew that so many of their optical sources, particularly the bright optical sources, have a sort of fair number of them are variable. Variables of various sorts.
So you were thinking of my analogy with variable stars.
That's right, yes. Yeah. And, of course, we were very wrong, because all the quasars that we now know are very highly variable, but they're mainly variable at the ratio of high frequencies.
Right.
So, and the other thing which, of course, we weren't able to detect is the long-term variation of Cass.
Well, that took a long term,
actually. Took a long time, yes. Over 18 months, we certainly saw no variation.
Well, it's rather interesting that you quoted the upper limit to the variations as a tenth of a magnitude. Well, but obviously trying to bridge the gap, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
To the optical astronomers.
Yes, that's true.
Rather than saying 10%.
Yes.
You put it that way.
Yes.
The next thing I have you down for is indeed looking at Perseus A, and I guess the idea of this was to find out whether the radio emission was coming from the galaxy or the whole cluster, is that right?
That's right. Well, John Baldwin at that stage was beginning to develop the scheme for measuring diameters of radio sources.
Which scheme are you referring to?
Well, again, the variable baseline sort of measurements, similar things that we were doing originally on the Sun, on the quiet Sun. He extended it to to radio sources, because by then we had the sufficient technique to be able to do this. And this was quite an interesting case, because we had, I think, a sort of point source plus a halo, which we got for this. So we detected some radiation coming from the cluster as a whole, and some coming from NGC 1275.
75% came from the galaxy.
That's right. And 25% from the halo, or something like that.
Has that turned out to be basically right today?
I think it is, yes.
The next thing I come across is the 2C survey, which had a checkered history, of course.
That's probably best forgotten.
Well, from a historical point of view, it's quite important, though.
Yes.
Can you tell me about the taking of the data there and the role that you, I mean, in particular, that you played in the building of the aerial or the data analysis?
It was a joint effort with, as you probably gather, quite a number of authors.
Right.
I think the part that I played in the 2C was, in fact, really the calibration of the system. And for this, we basically calibrated it on the brightest radio sources, measured them relative to that. The great problem there, of course, was that it saw far too many sources. It was very confusion limited, and so we sort of read in very many more sources than we ought to have done.
Right.
But if we'd limited the depth to which we analysed the records, it would have been quite a useful survey. The trouble is we went much too deep.
Well, but it would have been quite a limitation. I think it turns out that 80 or 90% of them are not good.
So that's right, yes.
Only been left with a couple hundred.
That's right, yes. We didn't realize at the time just how confusion limited the whole thing was.
Do you have any theories in retrospect to how this came about?
No, I think what basically happened is we had this very good interferometer pattern produced by the sky every day, and we were more or less instructed that there must be, you know, hundreds of sources there. Get down and sort them out, sort of thing.
I see.
And we went through this procedure with perhaps too much enthusiasm.
Hmm.
I can't quite put my finger on the reason why the 2C survey was so bad. I'm sure other people have looked at this much more closely than I have.
Yeah.
Come up with some quite good.
Well, I've gotten a number of opinions, but I'm just interested in.
Yes.
What yours was?
I don't think I was very involved with the fainter sources, although we all shared a great sort of routine for analysing so many records a day, you know.
The problem
was that there was quite a mass of data being poured out by the instrument, and we had a sort of slavish job trying to keep up with the output. So we more or less took it in shifts to analyse the data,
right,
which was really a very bad thing to do.
Why?
Well, I think we all had our own personal ways of analysing the records, and this probably led to more confusion than there already was.
Confusion in a different sense.
Confusion in a different sense, right. Yes. But
so there was no really agreed upon set of criteria for what was the source you're implying?
Well, there probably was. I mean, we probably tried to establish a sort of uniformity, but It was very difficult, because the records were simply so, I mean, we just have a whole series of sort of sine waves that vary in amplitude. The object of the exercise was to sort of draw an envelope from around the series of waves and say, well, that must be a source at that position, and we measure the period, or by other means, to get the declination. And, of course, this is a very dangerous procedure, because if you've got a whole string of a sort of sine waves or slightly different period and amplitude, different people draw different envelopes around them.
Right.
And I think the one basic mistake that we made is that when we analyse these, we tended to convince ourselves that there was a genuine source there by actually penciling in the envelope that we thought we were looking at. Of course, when the next person came along, he would see this envelope drawn in and would be inclined to agree with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they really were not independent checks, is what you're saying.
So that's, I think, probably where the mistake one of the basic mistakes we made with the analysis it probably originated.
Mm-hmm. I don't think you were particularly involved in the whole controversy over the 2C survey, except naturally being a part of the Cambridge group, you were very interested in it.
Yes.
I see you were a co-author on the paper given at the Paris Symposium. Did you go to that meeting?
Yes.
The Paris Symposium?
Yes, I went to Paris.
In which 3C was compared with 2C and with the MSH and POD and the whole business. Can you tell me about what went on at that meeting?
I seem to remember, though my memory is a bit vague about the Paris meeting. In fact, the thing I did at the Paris was to talk about the lunar atmosphere, which I...
Well, I'm coming to that, later on.
Yes. I presented a paper on the lunar atmosphere rather than took very active part in this other discussion.
Right. But as a participant...
But as a participant, I do seem to remember people getting rather hot under the collar on that occasion. And it was unfortunate, because I think that we all more or less agree that 2C was no good, and it was perhaps unfortunate that the Australian observers, radio astronomers, who were themselves are doing very much the same sort of thing as we were, they were very critical of our work, probably quite correctly, but they... I think we're a little rude in their attack on us.
Mm-hmm.
And this, I seem to remember, offended Martin rather a lot.
Yeah.
And he took it very much to heart. And sort of off the record, it produced a sort of feeling that it's taken a long time to get over.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is very unfortunate. And I suppose it's quite justifiable if they discover great errors in our observations. I mean, they probably treat many of the things which we turn out subsequent years with somewhat sort of doubt and casted queries about it.
Do you think this actually got in the way of the science for some years? These personal rivalries and such?
No, I don't really think they did. I think they might really have added an impetus to more of a drive to try and prove, that we're right and they're wrong, sort of thing. And in both camps, I can imagine that this would cause quite a lot of initiative and drive to be put into the measurements and so on.
Now, you said that the Cambridge group, as they went to this Paris Symposium, realized that most of the 2C individual sources were not good.
Yes.
But I've gotten the impression that you were banking on the P of D analysis, is that right?
Yes.
Nevertheless, that the cosmological results...
The cosmological results were in fact still held.
Right.
Yes.
But this was hard for others to accept.
I think it must have been very hard, because if you can prove that a lot of the sources aren't really there and other people find them in other parts of the sky, then any statistical analysis that we might do, I should have thought it was very difficult to believe.
It looks like a sort of a rear guard action.
Although I understand that the statistical analysis was fairly sound.
This is what I haven't gone through it.
Equation
by equation, but I think that indeed it turns out that way.
Yes.
It was part one of the interview with Bruce Elsmore on 19th August 1976.